ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. My respected and dear brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My special salutations to Sheikh Ridwan, who's one of the local scholars in the community, who has graced us with his presence tonight. The topic that is being addressed in these nightly speeches is the topic of the revolution of the self or the soul. And I'd like to begin tonight's discussion by going to a verse of the Quran that describes a very important event that will take place in the hereafter. We know that the hereafter, according to the Quran, what takes place, there'll be different stages and different things that happen to all of us. And every one of these stages and any description that God tells us about the hereafter is very important for us. It's important not just because it's something that's true, because it is true. It's important not just because if Allah chooses to mention it in the Quran, then it must be important enough and something very relevant for us. But it's important in addition because when Allah tells us something about the hereafter, He's giving us a chance to set ourselves up for being in the right place from here and now. And this is very important. When we read the Quran, especially this is the month of the Quran, everything has a springtime. And in hadith, we're told that the springtime of the Quran is the month of Ramadan. So when we're reading the Quran, we shouldn't just pass by these verses easily and say, okay, Allah's describing some scene. No, He's describing a scene and there's something in it for us. Inside all of us, there's a question that's burning that needs to be answered. What's that question? The question is, what's going to happen to us? Because we see that people live and they die. And we know that death is not the end. So what is going to happen afterwards? This verse describes a very important event that's going to take place. Allah says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. And this is from Surah Hud, verse 82. وَيَوْمَ نَحْشُرُهُمْ جَمِيعًا. On that day, when we shall gather all of them together. ثُمَّ نَقُولُ لِلَّذِينَ أَشْرَكُوا. There'll be some among these. There'll be a group among all of these who did shirk, who associated with God. What is Allah going to say to these people? مَكَانُكُمْ أَنْتُمْ وَشُرَكَاءُكُمْ. He'll say that you have your own place here. Now this is describing reality. Allah is saying that there'll be some who don't belong with the others. They have a special place set aside from them. You and the people that you used to associate with, you're here. And then what's going to take place? Allah goes on to say, فَزَيَّلْنَا بَيْنَهُمْ وَقَالَ شُرَكَاؤُهُمْ مَا كُنْتُمْ إِيَّانَ تَعْبُدُونَ. Allah will cause something to happen. What will it be? You see, this notion of association is described to us in a very picturesque way here. where Allah says that when you're associating with something other than God, you have a connection with that thing. In the old days, it used to be idols of wood and stone and other objects that people would take and worship. In today's world, we have our own set of idols, our own set of entities, our own set of ideas and concepts and isms that we bow to. We form connections with these things. We form identity with them. We take orders from them. But on the Day of Judgment, when we're gathered with them, Allah will show us the reality of these connections. فَزَيَّلْنَا بَيْنَهُمْ. What this means is that these connections that we have will be removed. They'll disappear. And then those idols and those false gods that people were worshipping will then make a claim. They'll say that, مَا كُنْتُمْ إِيَّانَا تَعْبُدُونَ. You thought that you used to worship us, but in fact, you weren't worshipping us. Because there was nothing that we could give you. There was no point in your trying to take orders and take a cue from us. The question that we have to ask ourselves, brothers and sisters, and I want you to think about this. I asked you last night to think, and this night as well, too. I'm asking you to ponder and reflect. Is what are those things that we associate with? What are those entities, those isms, those objects that drive us and make us do certain things in this society, in today's world? Tonight, inshallah, tomorrow night, I want to speak about one of these false gods of our times, which is a false notion of success and progress. Now, I want to start out by asking a question of all of you, and you can answer it yourselves, inshallah, which is a simple question. Is success something which is good? Is it good to be successful? So you can either nod your heads or shake your heads, right? If you have anyone, what do you think about that? Right? Just ask yourself, is success something good? Is progress something which is good? Yes, no? Okay, good. So pretty much most people are nodding their heads. And in fact, if you were to say to anybody that progress is something, hey, wait a minute, don't progress. Right? Don't succeed. People would look at you funny, right? What are you talking about? You know, progress, success, I mean, these are things which, they're like, it's almost like God, right? I mean, it's synonymous to something which you cannot question, that these things are good and these things are beneficial. Now, I want to jump straight into the point I want to, inshallah, present and try to convince the listeners of and you of, inshallah, which is that when we think about it, actually, from an Islamic perspective, we can't be so quick and easy to say that success and progress is something which is always good. But rather, we need to be a bit more sophisticated about it. And in fact, if we go and look at what this society around us defines as being success, we see that sometimes it matches with our understanding of what's successful, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes progress is something which is good from an Islamic perspective, and sometimes it's not. In fact, it's not really progress. Now, let's go and open this up a little bit further. When you go to somebody on the street and you ask them, what does it mean to be successful? They'll be like, yeah, it means to like have it made for yourself. You have a good education, a good job, good family, good car, good house. You got things pretty much set when it comes to the way you operate in this world. You're leading a comfortable and a happy life. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's something that we accept and we'd like for ourselves and we yearn for as well too. But the question I'd like to pose is that, is that it? Is that the only thing that makes somebody successful, is how it is that we operate in this material world? Let me ask you a question. What makes one person more successful than another person? Is it the number of figures they have in the salary that they're making? Is it the one who has the Beamer versus the one who has the Hyundai? Right? What is it? In fact, is it right to even just consider success and progress and development and civilization as being something which is limited to the material realm? And so when we look at it and we think about it from an Islamic perspective, from a God-conscious perspective, we have to be more sophisticated about this definition of success and progress. And what we're going to say is that, you know what? Success and progress is not something which is just a matter of moving on a horizontal sphere and just being getting more and getting bigger and getting better. But there's a vertical notion as well too, and that's progress in terms of elevation, in terms of spiritual elevation. Now I think you see where I'm getting to here. What I'm getting to is that when it's the case that success and progress is done and is attained for the purpose of spiritual and vertical progress and perfection, that's something that we support. But when it's something that's done for the sake of material progress and success, then that's something, and just for that, that's something that doesn't jive with Islamic principles. Now, I know that might have been a bit philosophical. I'd like to explain this with some examples from the Quran and Hadith. Please help me with a loud recitation of Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. There's a notion in our society that technology is something which is very good. And it's very important for us to pursue technology. It's been something that has been around for some time, and as days go on and years pass, we become more and more, our lives become more and more intertwined with technology, then technology has become something that we all sort of use and also think of as being very good and very important. In fact, a lot of us will say that what defines us as a society and makes us more advanced than people of the past is that we have technology. Now, I'd like you to go to the Quran. I'll take you there, inshallah. Let's look at the Quran and see what it has to say about peoples of the past who were technologically advanced. Is being technically advanced a sure sign of being advanced in the sight of God and being successful in the eyes of God? There were a people whose name was the people of Ad. And they had attained technological advances that were unparalleled. Their strength was in building. They were able to build things that no nation had ever built before them. And at least until the revelation of the Quran, even after them, nobody had matched what they were able to do. The Quran tells us, in the words of the prophet that was sent to them, أَتَبْنُونَ بِكُلِّ رِيْعٍ آيَةً تَعْبَثُونَ. On every prominent location of their land, they would build like a fancy building. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, right? Like, if you just go and look at the skyline, it reminds me a bit of that, where everyone's, at least at one time, maybe now these days there's been a recession, but for some years back, every other location, every other plot would be under construction, and everyone's trying to outdo the other one. Here's a hotel in the form of a ship. Here's a hotel which is underwater. Here's a hotel which is, floating in the air, and all these different types of things. These people of Ad were people who were advanced, and they used to build these buildings. Now, what's important is that they would build them not for the purpose of helping humanity, not for the purpose of assisting the poor or helping the oppressed or getting closer to God. No, none of that. They would do this, in the words of their prophet, ta'abathun, for no purpose, just to play around. It was a pastime. وَتَتَّخِذُونَ مَصَانِعَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَخْلُدُونَ. And he tells them, Nabi Hud alayhi salam tells them, he says that you set up structures for yourselves. Do you imagine that you're going to be immortal? Have you forgot that there's something else after this life that you have to worry about? Now, these people, in history, we're told that they had a city which was named Iram. And the Quran in another place describes that Irama dhatil imad, it was a city of pillars. Some say that the lost city of Atlantis was the same as the city of Iram. Right? It was a city of unparalleled beauty and architecture. They were advanced, they were progressed, they had technology, but what happens to them? They turn away from their prophet and they get destroyed. Not because God is mean, not because God, na'udhu billah, wants to destroy people who are trying, no. Because they themselves brought it upon themselves. So when we go back and analyze it, we have to say, wait a minute. That notion of success, where we define that on the basis of how much we have, just how much technology we can produce, that's not valid. That's not enough. Let's ask this question. Why is it that in Islam, the notion of success and the notion of progress is something which goes beyond just a horizontal acquisition of things? It goes back to our understanding of what the human being is. We believe in progress. We believe in success. But we believe that we're human beings. And there's a difference between us and other creations of God. If we were just animals, then yes, success would be defined to be seeing who can get the most, acquire the most, be the fastest. But we believe that a human being consists of a body and a soul. And of these two, that which has more importance, that which is more lasting, that which we have to preserve with the utmost care and be concerned about developing and purifying is the soul. And the body is a means to be able to purify the soul. And so therefore, our notion of what's successful and what's good for us and what's progress has to encompass both these dimensions. If it's something which is just related to the body, then that's going to be something which falls short for us. Unfortunately, brothers and sisters, what we find is that even though we're living in times that people consider, you know, civilization to be more advanced than it's ever been, technology to be more advanced than it ever was, we see that actually there hasn't been that much progress that's been made. One of our contemporary scholars, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, may Allah protect him, preserve him, he, in his opinion, and this opinion is shared by many scholars, he says that, look, there was a time, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, there was a time when, before the coming of Islam, people used to live in Jahiliyyah. And that period of Jahiliyyah, the period of ignorance and stupidity, was a period that was characterized by a number of very abhorred actions. For example, we've heard about these things. Things like that when a couple would have a baby who was born who was female, oftentimes they would bury that female in the sand. They would be humiliated. They would feel that it was a humiliation to be given a daughter. There were people who would eat the worst types of things from the land. There were people who would shed blood for the smallest of things. They say that one of the wars that lasted decades started because a camel of one tribe, you know, happened to stray into the garden of another tribe. That camel started eating from there. That tribe saw the camel, shot an arrow at the camel. The arrow hit the hump of the camel. And then the owner of the camel was a lady who was very upset because her camel's hump had been struck by this arrow. Her nephew decided to take revenge for her and went and started killing the people of the other tribe. And so they started getting into battle, and it went on, and it developed into a rivalry that lasted for years and years and years. Anyway, Ayatollah Jawadi says in one of his works, he says that period of Jahiliyyah is something which takes different shapes and forms. Don't think that it's just limited to one time in history. You can have more advanced forms of Jahiliyyah like we're having in today's world as well. Back in those days, they used to kill and bury these female children when they were born out of humiliation. These days, it happens as well too, but they're a little bit more sophisticated about it. You know what they do? They go and they have an ultrasound early on. They determine the gender, and this happens, right? And they do it in a more discreet sort of way. You know, so that no one can really find out about it. Sometimes it's not even limited to whether it's a female. It's even worse. Whether it be a male or a female, if it's an unwanted pregnancy, they'll go and they abort. In those days, they used to eat things which were gross from the earth. In today's world, we see that people are eating things and they look really good. They look really, really fancy and they're packaged really nicely. But many times if you go and look and see what it's about and what sort of effects it has on the human body, you'll realize that, wait a minute, it's just a more advanced form of the same sort of stuff. In those days, they used to shed blood for no apparent reason. Today, one of the most advanced forms of technology is something that's called the drone. And with this drone that's supposed to be, you know, something that helps save our soldiers' lives, what happens is that you have innocent people who are blown out of the water just because a drone operator who's sitting thousands of miles away decides to press the button. And it's like a game for him. You know, like you have a joystick and you have like this little plane and you go and like you shoot these people down. Okay, but it's shedding real blood and innocent blood, and it's for no reason. So we should not be deluded, brothers and sisters. We should understand that even though times have changed, the forms of technology have advanced in terms of things are faster, things are better. But the reality is that all of these, if you put them together, for the most part, they haven't helped human beings advance closer to God. Please recite As-salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Once our fourth Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin al-Islam, was performing the Hajj, and one of his companions was there by the name of Zuhri. And Zuhri was talking to the Imam alayhi salam. The Imam was trying to show him some of the realities of the rites of pilgrimage. It's a very interesting discussion that happens. Along the way, the Imam alayhi salam makes a comment to him, according to one of the narrations, one of the books which narrates this encounter. The Imam tells Zuhri, he says, "Ya Zuhri, ma akthara dajij wa aqalla al-hajij." This is how many hujjaj there are. Sorry, how many people there are who are lamenting and crying out, but how few people who are there who are actually performing Hajj. Meaning that the Imam is telling them, look, you might think that there'll be a lot of people here who are performing Hajj. There's a lot of noise here, there's a lot of commotion, but in reality, there's very few hujjaj who are actually performing the Hajj. So the companion, Zuhri, he tells the Imam, he says that, wait, Imam, like all these people here, they're all hujjaj. Do you consider this to be a small number? The Imam al-Islam tells him, no, come near to me. He puts his hand on the face of Zuhri, he wipes it over him, and now suddenly Zuhri's vision changes. He sees, but now he sees with the insight of the Imam. And the Imam commands him to look at the scene that's in front of him. Zuhri says, the Imam, what I see now is completely different. I see that all of these people who are here, for the most part, they're nothing but monkeys. And among 10,000 of these monkeys, I see one human being. Now this hadith is one of those that should shake us up. It shouldn't make us despair. Sometimes people read these hadith and they say, wait a minute, so according to the Imam's perspective, that means most of us haven't even, we don't deserve to be called a human being? First of all, we should realize the times that the Imam is living in. This was after Karbala, soon afterwards, after the incident of Ashura. Right? There's a lot of people were ignorant. People were very backwards. The true meaning of Islam had been lost in many in many senses of the word. Alhamdulillah, in today's world, we have many people who are actively trying to find the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, act upon them, and work on them. So we shouldn't despair when we see this hadith, but it should cause us to reflect upon ourselves and see, are we really doing anything to qualify being human beings? Or is it the case that our notion of what's success and what's progress is something which is limited to what animals would do and nothing more? So, brothers and sisters, as we move towards conclusion, I want to make a couple of practical takeaways from this discussion. One of them is that we shouldn't be overly wowed by technology and by advances. Sometimes people think that, okay, you know, everyone else is following a certain path of what they determine to be success, which is that I have to go into a particular university track, I have to go into a particular career, I have to then work a certain number of hours and have this type of lifestyle. And sometimes people are willing to cut corners and do things which are questionable in order to attain that. They'll choose a career without even considering, wait a minute, is this something which is halal for me to pursue? Is my income going to be halal? Am I going to be able to use this income and buy clothing that I'll be wearing for salat and that will be valid, or will it make my salat invalid? What happens if my salat is invalid? And I know that the first thing I'm going to be questioned about in the hereafter is my salat. What about those things that I'll have to do as part of my job? Is that going to be halal for me? But even more than that, we have to consider the type of lifestyle we want to lead. A lot of people think that in order to be successful, I have to live a life which is big and really complex. Big house, big car, everything. And there's nothing wrong with that. Right? It's not haram, and attaining this world and having a purpose behind it, a valid purpose, there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes people think that in order to do that, they impose so many things upon themselves, when if they're looking for happiness, they can find happiness in living a simpler form of life. I was just listening to a talk that was forwarded to me. You know, there's a series of talks that are called TED Talks. You must have seen them on YouTube. They're small talks by, you know, different people. They talk about different things that inspire them. There's one that struck me. It was about this one a villager who lived in, I believe it was in Indonesia. And he was living in a village. Now, everyone is telling them, look, if you want to be successful, you have to go into the big city and you have to, you know, do certain things there. You have to go to university, get a job, etc. So he did that. You know, he left his village. He went to the big city. He started, you know, studying in university and, you know, living that type of lifestyle. But he realized that, you know what? This type of life is not something which is making him happy. He was much happier in his village where, you know, he had good food, he had good things to do, and this type of lifestyle was killing him. And then he goes on to explain some of the benefits of living a simple life. He says that, look, what I did is I quit that thing. I went back to my village. What I do now is I live simply. I work 2 hours a day where I tend to my rice farm. But it doesn't require any more time than that. The rest of the time I have is for myself and my family. And we have fun. Right, we enjoy the nature, we have time to do things that are of interest to us. He says that, for example, people in my village will carve handles for knives out of wood. And in today's world, everything is based on like plastic, right? But people have time for this type of thing. He says that I had a classmate who was at the top of the class in university. And he's still struggling to find a house in the big city for himself. But I and my children are able to build huts for ourselves. And my problem isn't about finding a house, it's about picking which house I want to stay in on a particular night. He says that I have time to reflect on myself and to think about what my purpose is, to think about what it is that I really want and what I really need. Not just going with the notion of being fed by others and told that this is what you have to do and this is what you need to do. Now, am I saying, brothers and sisters, that we need to all go and set up camp in this remote village of India, of Indonesia, and grow rice and learn how to do that? No, I'm saying that sometimes we need to reflect on why is it that we're part of this rat race? Do we understand what true success actually is? What sort of progress are we aiming for? And these are questions that we need to ask ourselves. If we answer them correctly, we might see that our life starts to change. Sometimes I might need to move myself away from that for a greater purpose. For example, one of the things we know is that according to Islamic teachings, the raising of a child and the upbringing of a child is the responsibility of the father and the mother. But the bulk of that, especially at the younger age, is to be done by the mother. And if the mother is a career-minded woman and she makes that be her priority for the sake of it, and there's no other reason, sometimes, you know, it's the woman has to work, there's no problem in that if the boundaries are observed and it's something which is halal. But if that becomes the focus and the goal without consideration of other things, then it can lead to problems. Now, if we talk to such a sister, sometimes you might say that, wait a minute, if I were to step back away from my career, then that's going to put me back in the race. I won't be successful. So I don't want that. But then we have to ask our sister, what is it that you define to be success? Is success something which is a matter of getting a good job and living the high life? Or is it a matter of doing our responsibility in front of God? If that's the case, even when we're at home and serving others, whether it be serving our children or whether it be serving our parents, sometimes we have to, you know, give up going away from college to serve our parents. If that's where our responsibility lies, then we should know that we're still making progress. Maybe we're not making so much progress in the material sense, but we are making it in the sense which really counts, which is the spiritual sense. Please recite, Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I want to end this discussion by just giving a couple of examples from the lives of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. They, in so many ways, wanted us to awaken to this reality. That look at your life here is short, your time is short. Don't be confused about what your goal is and what you're striving for. There's one time when there was a commotion in the mosque of the Prophet. And people were gathered around this one man who was telling stories to them. The Prophet goes to the mosque and he asks somebody, he says that, what's going on here? Why are so many people gathered around this person? So they tell him that, oh Prophet, this person who's here, he's somebody who is an allama, somebody who is very, very, very learned. So the Prophet asks him, he says that, mal allama, what do you define to be somebody who's really learned? What's your definition of being educated? So they tell him, well, oh, he's the person who knows the lineage of the different tribes of the Arabs the best. You know, he can tell the stories of everyone's father and their grandfathers and their forefathers and their grandmothers and everything else. So the Prophet tells him, wait a minute. He wants to redefine their notion of what does it mean to be educated. He says that that's a knowledge, la yadurru man jahilahu. وَلَا يَنْفَعُ مَنْ عَلِمَهُ. That doesn't help the one who knows it. It doesn't harm the one who doesn't know it. But he says that true knowledge is three things. Ayatun muhkama, faridatun adila, or a sunnatun qa'ima. Right? There's three things which are important for us to know. And ulama have explained these to mean that these map to the ahkam and the aqaid and the akhlaq of Islam, the laws and the ethics and the beliefs of Islam. These are the things that are most important for us to know. So you see, on one hand, they discourage us from being caught into the trap of following whatever the society defines to be educated and advanced. On the other hand, they promote examples of individuals who are able to progress on a spiritual level. One time, again, the Prophet went to the mosque and he saw there was a young man who was there, whose name was Harith. He goes to Harith. Imagine the Prophet goes to him and he asks him, oh Harith, how are you doing? Haritha tells him, he says that, oh Messenger of Allah, I woke up this morning in a state of certainty regarding my faith. The Prophet tells him, oh Haritha, لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ حَقِيقًا, for everything there's a reality. What is the reality of your faith? Prove it. Why are you in the state of conviction and certainty? He says, oh Messenger of Allah, and then he goes on to describe his state. He says that a few different things, but among them, he says that I've reached that stage where it's as if I can see the people who are in paradise and I see them enjoying the bounties of paradise. It's as if I can see the people who are in the fire and I can hear the wails of the hellfire as well too. Yes, there are people who can reach these realities even in this world as well. And the Prophet wants to promote these people. He says that هذا عبد نور الله قلبه بالإيمان. This is a servant whose heart Allah has illuminated. The Prophet isn't saying that we don't need to go and get a good education, we don't need to get a good job, and we don't need to go and develop things and work on technology, no. He's saying that don't limit yourself to that. There's other realities as well too. All these are meant to be a means towards a greater goal. It's a month of Ramadan, brothers and sisters. It's a month in which we need to realign ourselves with correct goals, understand why we're here, what we're doing. I'll end now with just a word about the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in this month. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhim we're told, because after all, we don't want to just have these speeches be information. We want to awaken our hearts as well too a little bit. We're told that Imam Zainul Abidin in this month, he would gather all of his servants together. And instead of being angry at them for what they would do, he would be extra lenient to them. And at the end of the month, he would show them pieces of paper that he had written for each one of them. And he would say that, look at all these things that I written here. Are they not things that you had done which were contrary to the agreement that we had with you? And they would say that, yes, our master, we agreed that we did these things. And then he would gather them all together and he would tell them, I want all of you to say in a loud voice together, Ya Ali ibn al-Husayn, O Ali, the son of Husayn, the same way that your Lord has kept track of all the things that you have done, and all of these are recorded in a book, and the same way that you have recorded those things that we have done, so the same way that you can forgive us, we ask your Lord to forgive you on that day. Look at the generosity and the mercy of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. What must have been he been thinking as he's hearing what's happening on that night after the day of Ashura? What kind of brutality is this man who has such a soft heart, such a heart desiring to help other people? What is he thinking as he's hearing and what's happening to the women folk of the Ahlul Bayt on that night? We end with saying salams to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. صلى الله عليكم يا أهل أهل بيت النبوة وموضع الرسالة. السلام عليكم يا أهل بيت الرسول. We're told that on that night there was a daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who among all the commotion is approached by a man who wants to rip off the bracelets from her ankles. And she sees that he's crying. She asks him, "Oh, the enemy of Allah, you're an enemy of Allah. Why are you crying when you're doing this? How can you do this while you're crying? And you are robbing this from the daughter of the Messenger of Allah." He says that if I don't do it, who is going to do it other than me? This is the type of brutality that Imam alayhi salam is witnessing, but he is unable to do anything because of his condition. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimin. Wa say'alamu al-ladhina zalamu ayyaman qalibin yanqalibun. Sallu ala Muhammad.